the presentation of Dickinson College's annual Benjamin Rush Award. The award and lecture were established through the generosity of the late Wilbur M. Rabinowitz, a former trustee and a member of the class of 1940. Each year since 1985, the college has presented an award in the memory and legacy of our founder, the esteemed Philadelphia physician, Dr. Benjamin Rush. The purpose of this award is to recognize outstanding achievement in the field of business or government, and to honor an individual whose career has been distinguished by a commitment to the ideals and values of the liberal arts. There could be no greater tribute to honor and celebrate the intentions and convictions of Benjamin Rush. A revolutionary and a signer of the Declaration of Independence, Rush was passionately committed to ensuring the success of the new democracy and the fledgling economy. Rush knew that the new nation could live up to its own expectations only if it was inhabited by citizens and leaders educated through an approach to liberal arts that was distinctively American. It is for this express reason that Rush founded Dickinson College. Rush advanced a liberal arts education that would ultimately be useful and applicable to all professions, conspicuously including business and finance. For Rush, commerce and manufacturing, finance were defining and integral components of the new democracy, and he was determined that his vision, a new distinctively American vision of a liberal arts education, would provide the intellectual capital necessary to allow the emerging nation to excel in these areas. As early as 1769, he wrote, quote, "There is but one expedient left whereby we can save our sinking country, and that is by encouraging American manufacturers. Unless we do this, we shall be done forever." He was not always optimistic, by the way. All right. As Rush's conception of an American liberal arts education took shape, he specifically rejected the European model that catered to the elite and was reserved exclusively for those who were already wealthy and privileged. For Rush, an American liberal education was to be above all, as I said, useful. While this approach to education was to be solidly and rigorously rooted in traditional studies, Rush also expected students to explore emerging branches of knowledge and to communicate creatively across subject areas. Rush also acknowledged that there was indeed a spirit of creativity that people possess, and he suggested forcibly that Americans possess it in abundance, and this through the coming centuries would be a definition for us as a people. This spirit would fuel America's emerging proficiency for invention and innovation, those twin qualities that would soon make our country a commercial and industrial force. He also appreciated keenly that economic energy in a people must be balanced through an education engaging ethics, religion, and philosophy. Rush's vision and legacy continue to guide Dickinson College today. We continue to strive to prepare our students to become the citizens and the leaders of our communities, our country, and our world by offering them a liberal arts education that is still both challenging and useful. We continue to maintain that a liberal arts education is the best preparation an individual can have for any profession, to include business and finance. And we continue to encourage our students to venture beyond these limestone walls to engage the world and to explore all opportunities and avenues possible to apply their liberal arts education creatively. This is the legacy we honor today as we present the Benjamin Rush Award. We can think of no better way to express our commitment to Dr. Rush's vision than recognizing those who have demonstrated the value of these ideals through their successful and engaged careers. It is now my distinct pleasure to turn over the podium to Melissa Lafferty, who will introduce our speaker. Melissa is currently a senior, completing a major in policy management. Originally from Corcoranville, Pennsylvania, Melissa is highly engaged in campus activities, involving herself in the ever-growing Italian Club, as well as the Model United Nations. She also spent time in Bologna at our site there. All of this, of course, is balanced by her work as project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. Melissa?
Thank you, Dr. Durden. Good evening. My name is Melissa Lafferty, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to welcome you to this evening's event, Addressing Climate Change, a Least Cost Strategy. In recent years, some of the warmest temperatures in history have been recorded. These warm temperatures can be attributed to greenhouse gases trapped in our atmosphere. Although greenhouse gases sustain the warm temperatures necessary for life on Earth, the rise in these temperatures has had several negative impacts on the planet. Some of these effects include the melting of Arctic ice, more frequent and violent hurricanes, and shifts in growing seasons and precipitation patterns. Scientists are confident that human industrial activity has had a significant effect on the rising temperature levels. If our way of life is not modified and emissions are not reduced, it is likely we will experience further climate changes. Severe climate changes could cause loss in coral reefs, decreased crop production, and subsequent hunger, as well as more widespread tropical illness. Tonight, Roger W. Sant will discuss the best ways to address climate change. Mr. Sant is the co-founder and former chairman of the board of the AES Corporation. He's an environmentalist who led the AES Corporation to plant 50 million trees in South America's rainforests. He founded Finnegan Instruments, a chemical instrumentation company, as well as the Energy Productivity Center at Carnegie Mellon University. Mr. Sant also worked as a professor of finance at the Stanford University School of Business. He is the chairman of the board of the Summit Fund and Summit Foundation of Washington. He received his bachelor's degree from Brigham Young University and his MBA from the Harvard University School of Business. Mr. Sant is the recipient of the 2007 Benjamin Rush Award. At this time, I would like to ask that you disable all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because this event is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. And now, please join me in welcoming Mr. Roger W. Sant.
Thank you all. It's a pleasure to be back here. 15 years ago, I was here last, and that was when our son Lex, who is in the front row, in fact, stand up, Lex. That's it's my legacy. he graduated at that time, and it was one of the more pleasurable experiences of my life. I have a lot of great memories, but today I think I even had even a better experience in understanding the commitment and the enthusiasm of all of you towards sustainability. Sustainability is certainly an issue that's been on my mind, and it seems to be even more on your minds, and it's been a great deal of pleasure today to watch the demonstration of that commitment, not just the words that people express, but the real commitment, and I compliment you, President Durden, for that. It's an amazing accomplishment. This college is showing its effort to be thoughtful and responsible in the consumption of resources, particularly energy, and in preparing the students, you the students, to face up to the substantial challenges that we have left for you to repair and protect the global environment. More than 30 years ago, I was confirmed by the Senate as an Assistant Energy Administrator for Conservation in the U.S. Federal Energy Administration, as many of you recall, not very many of you recall, but that was the energy crisis. That was the first time this nation really faced up to what we Americans had to look at as our energy needs. And it was the first time since World War II, really, that we had ever addressed the questions of consumption of energy. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting States, or OPEC, as we fondly become acquainted with them, asserted its pricing authority. And those of you who remember, gasoline prices went way, way up, and there were shortages of gasoline, long lines, and a lot of thirsty automobiles as people waited in those lines. In the 2 years I spent with FEA, we came up with some truly modern inconveniences, like the noble 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. a rule that Lex and I ignored completely coming up here today. But back then, most people thought about energy and consumption as a problem of supply. If we could just get our hands on enough oil, we didn't have much to worry about. We called it Project Independence at that time. It was coined by President Nixon. In fact, the same purpose, the same solution, the same parlance today is called energy security. It's much the same approach. And the people who advocate today are informed by the same bias. They're trying to figure out how to boost the supply of energy. So when President Bush talks about increasing the supply of ethanol and biofuels to 35 billion gallons, he's talking about a solution that's dependent on looking to sources of supply as a way of eliminating the need to reduce oil consumption. To me, it's ridiculous, because how long is it going to take us to get it? The answer really lies on the demand side, not the supply side. I believe that if we ever commit ourselves to solving the problems of global warming in this country, our lowest cost solution, the way we create actual energy abundance, must come from a reduction in demand that results from investments in conservation. So I'm not arguing that conservation requires a moral position. It doesn't. It doesn't hurt, but it doesn't require it. And I don't think that it needs to be motivated by personal virtue. It's a low-cost strategy. In fact, it's the lowest-cost strategy. It's the cheapest way to solve a big part of the problem. We'll have to change the way we behave, but we can actually do that by changing the way we think about consumption. Many of you, particularly the students, may be familiar with a study that was produced by McKinsey and Company earlier this year that really captured my attention. It created a cost curve for greenhouse gas reductions. In the study, which asserts to be the first macroeconomic study of the cost of reducing global CO2 emissions, the cheapest six sources of abatement, all of which had a negative cost of implementation, were related to conservation. Here's what McKinsey assumed. They used a scenario that saw us stabilizing greenhouse gases at 450 parts per million of CO2 equivalent by the year 2030, which is about 50% higher than pre-industrial levels, but only 17% higher than the current level. They were trying for a scenario that would limit the global increase in temperature to less than 2 degrees centigrade, or about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm not sure that 450 parts per million level is low enough, but sadly, most of the world that is concerned about the problem today, which of course does not include the United States, is fixed on a target of 550 parts per million, quite a bit higher. So it'll take a lot of persuading by a lot of us to get that target to a goal of 450. According to McKinsey, that target would require the elimination of about 45% of the carbon dioxide that's projected for the year 2030. Not a small task, which according to McKinsey would then clear the market at a marginal cost of around $50 per ton of carbon dioxide. Now that's an important number to keep in mind, because $50 per ton would roughly double the price of wholesale electricity. So that's not a mean accomplishment and not a modest price increase. But here's the good news. Fully one quarter of that abatement could come from efficiency-enhancing measures that have negative net costs and would have no detrimental impact on the levels of comfort. And fully three quarters of the potential to reduce emission comes from measures that are not reliant on technology or any brand new discoveries. It would rely on existing available and affordable technologies. It's only the last quarter of the abatement that is quite expensive. What that suggests is that we certainly need to look at new technologies like carbon sequestration, which some of us have been talking about today. Of course we must. But when we concentrate on solutions that don't exist, we're ignoring the fact that there's a substantial portion of the solution that exists right now. So what are those six negative cost solutions? It won't surprise you. In descending order of impact, they are building insulation, commercial vehicle efficiency improvements, lighting systems, air conditioning, water heating, and fuel efficiency in passenger vehicles. Not very sophisticated stuff, but wow, what an impact. And what do these things have in common? They're all distributed source of conservation, so they're reliant on individual consumer choices, people like you and me. I'll bet that the people at Dickinson that live in Treehouse don't feel like the quality of their living experience is diminished by the fact that their ecological footprint is a small one. In fact, as we visited there today, it probably enhances the quality of their living experience. They probably like it a lot more than the old-style housing that dominates Carlisle and every other community in the United States. And I think the same thing will be true for every tenant in every office building that is built in the District of Columbia, which recently, amazingly, mandated that all new construction, at a minimum, meet the same LEED standards to which the treehouse was built. Imagine the capital of our country requiring that all new construction be built to that standard. That's an amazing trend. Those buildings may have a marginally higher cost in construction, but they have a much lower operating cost even before you account for all the pollution they avoid. So I'll argue that buildings that meet LEED standards are better buildings because they solve for new design criteria that we haven't had before. The paradigm of what constitutes good design is being extended to include the efficiency of consumed resources, particularly fuel. Bill McDonough, who some of you have heard of or met at the University of Virginia, points out that human populations are the only populations in the world that have a concept of waste. In every other population, the waste product of one natural process becomes food for another process. That intertangling of processes and organisms is at the root of ecosystems, and the preservation of biodiversity recognizes those relationships. But humans throw things away. They create products that, once used, become useless. Yet we already see an evolution, I believe, that acknowledges the natural disharmony that comes from those patterns of consumption. When Lex graduated from Dickinson 15 years ago, the college was just beginning to recycle. Today, the college has a Center for Sustainable Living and a commitment to have a zero carbon footprint. We're in a different era. In 15 years, the pace of change is demonstrably a fast one. Jesse Fink started Priceline.com, the web portal that provides low-cost airplane tickets to flexible travelers. Some of you have used it. You know what he's doing now? He started a private equity fund that's making money on helping to lead the transformation to carbon-sensitive markets. His company is called Mission Point Capital. Another example, I recently learned of some young MBAs, particularly that Lex knows, from Enron, not exactly a great name in the energy industry, but these guys just built the first house in Texas that the local utility has to pay to be a customer. That is, they're producing net energy. It has negative net electricity usage. The company is called Standard Renewable, and they're buying air conditioning companies and supercharging home insulation, just the things that the least cost strategy implies. I think they'll do very well. If we need to remove 25 or 26 billion tons of carbon dioxide per year in 2030, and the clearing price is $50 per ton, there's a potential market of more than $1 trillion per year. That kind of market opportunity has a persuasive effect on many of the people who have doubted the science behind climate change, and those skeptics are quickly becoming opportunists. And so I think there are powerful economic incentives that could transform methods of reducing human impact on the global climate. But those incentives won't be there if we depend on a regulatory, on voluntary compliance. A regulatory cap on emissions will be essential. With a partner, I started an electricity company in 1981 called AES, as has been mentioned. It was based on the deregulation of electricity markets. And in general, I think competitive markets in electricity have lowered the price of electricity to customers. And I believe that markets, when they're set up correctly, do help to solve problems by including a more burdened cost in the end price to a customer. The cap and trade system for sulfur dioxide, for example, is a very effective example of market response to an environmental problem. So I do think it makes sense to set up a market-based system and leave it up to global entrepreneurs to find the low-cost method of compliance. But to accomplish our goal, the market objectives must be consequential, something like the doubling of electricity prices that I mentioned. And the penalties for non-compliance have to be severe, because I don't think we can afford to fail. We can manage a system of increasing deregulation in electricity markets because they're basically local markets. But the threat of global warming is broad enough that we have to address the problem transnationally, which requires cooperation on a scale that is extremely difficult. Fortunately, the Kyoto Protocol gives us a start, but also illustrates what economists call a collective action problem. When everybody else is compliant and there's a market price that reflects the cost of compliance, one can have a great advantage by not cooperating. Right now, we're adding a little more than 42 billion tons of carbon dioxide per year to the atmosphere worldwide. And by 2030, that total is projected to grow to more than 58 billion tons per year. So I've said, even solutions that see our carbon emissions go up more slowly than they currently are, I think, insufficient. I think we have to do more to make radical changes. Market solutions can also create the wrong incentives. In the case of Kyoto, I think there's a very glaring omission. As most of you know, the Kyoto Protocol allows certain countries to produce market-traded offsets by eliminating greenhouse gas emissions. So, for example, if I capture the methane from a large industrial animal farm in India, I can earn credits for the reduced global warming effect that I can sell to Europe to offset emissions there. It reflects the global nature of the problem and creates a powerful incentive to reduce emissions. But Kyoto does not give credit for the preservation of existing forest lands that absorb CO2 as they grow and that release huge volumes of CO2 when they are burned or cleared. Trees are 50% carbon, so they store a huge amount. And UN statistics indicate that forests the size of Indiana are lost every year, resulting in 20 to 25% of the global emissions of CO2. That's kind of astounding to me, and it's why I think we should argue that we have to come up with some mechanism that rewards people for preservation of the existing trees, particularly in the rainforest. I will, and I hope you will, continue to support those that would pay people for avoiding deforestation. Those payments, I believe, are part of the least cost climate solution. Some analysts project that the total number of offsets available from carbon emission reductions projects in qualifying countries are about 10 billion tons or so per year. So if we keep cutting down the world's forests, we're going to have to do every carbon reduction project in the developing world just to stay even. So that means two things. One, we need to figure out how to motivate the preservation of our forests. And two, in industrialized countries, like our own, we have to reduce our carbon intensity pretty severely if we want to reduce greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere. So at the end here, I'd like to share what my own experience tells me will be the important elements of how we solve this problem. Back around 1988, when we and AES were building a 180-megawatt coal-fired power plant on the Thames River in Connecticut, a woman named Cheryl Sturgis had the idea to plant 52 million trees in Guatemala to offset the plant's lifetime emissions of carbon dioxide. I had been concerned at that time, rightly, that as the founder of a company that generated electricity from the combustion of coal, that we had a collective responsibility to provide some attention to the issue of climate change. Now, AES has grown to be a very large company. It is in the S&P 100 index. It's got more than $30 billion of assets around the world and revenues of greater than $11 billion each year, and it employs 30,000 people in 25 countries. But back then, we were trying to build a little power plant. We were tiny. We weren't public. We were a little more than a startup company, so it wasn't as though we felt like we were leading global capital markets. In fact, the money it cost to plant the trees was a lot of money to us in those days. But we did it. It gave us a chance to test the hypothesis that we had in forming a company that there didn't need to be a conflict between environmental and economic outcomes. And we are right, but there have been countless examples in the meantime to support that. At that time, we weren't so sure. I can say that I reject absolutely the assertions that profits are threatened by responsible behavior. If AES during my days there is any example, it's simply not true. And people who have a contrary view most likely have ignored the tremendous economic impact of climate change and other environmental destruction. But interestingly, the point of this story isn't that I had a great idea and then the company I started did it, because that's really not what happened. Somebody else had the idea. My contribution, I think that's my BlackBerry. May I? There's a funny thing about BlackBerries and sound systems. Anyway, that's not what happened. An organization like ours, someone with the idea had to make a crazy suggestion like Cheryl Sturgis did and not risk being ridiculed. The idea of planting 52 million trees to offset the carbon dioxide in 1988 was not exactly an idea that was prevalent. We wanted people that worked at AES to feel a sense of ownership in our company. It's not necessarily an easy thing to do, but nevertheless, that's what we were trying to do. So in the next few decades, you as the students at Dickinson and elsewhere are ascending to positions of responsibility, and you're creating new companies and organizations. Your collective view of leadership will be very important. And if there are any words that I can influence here, any people that I can influence here, take my word for it. You won't have most of the answers yourself. Leadership isn't about knowing everything you have to know and then telling everybody what to do. It's about learning from the people around you and enabling them to do their best work. In a world that demands new answers to seemingly intractable problems, we can ill afford to promote a version of leadership that suggests omnipotence. It will take all of us, and we must let our outdated ideas about leadership exclude people who will have better answers. What we have in front of us is a problem that will test the limits of our global systems. It presents hazards that are difficult for us to recognize because calamity seems so impossible. We are, by nature, an optimistic set of people. But this is a problem that affects our whole planet. Its consequences cannot be avoided without a coordinated and aggressive response. I mostly have faith that we'll collectively rise to the occasion. rise to the challenge now that an illusion of safety has been removed. After all, even optimists buy insurance. In many respects, the answers we can imagine are inspiring. They recognize the interconnectedness not only of our global habitats, but in truth, our global population. At a time when the world seems divided into parts, there is some encouragement that we will join together by necessity or risk the unthinkable. So if I can leave you with one idea tonight, it is to find ways to include everybody. Share your ideas in a world that seems to me to be increasingly fractured. Seek out what is similar while respecting what is different. After all, we do not need to be the same in order to seek the same outcome. A world in which human activities amplify the planet's beauty instead of consuming it. I am grateful for the chance to be here at Dickinson again. The school is, as it has so often been in its long history, providing a much-needed intellectual and social contribution. Thank you very much for having me here. Says they'll take questions. You don't have to have questions, but be delighted.
Hi. I'm wondering about, you mentioned coal as one of the sources of energy for AES, and I'm wondering if that's still a primary source of energy for the company and how that factors into decision making.
Yeah, we haven't built a coal plant in quite a while, but it still is the least cost way of generating power in most places in the world. So the pressures to build a coal-fired plant are pretty high, except where carbon dioxide is charged for. So the real challenge, I think, is to reflect the cost of carbon in a coal-fired plant, and then it won't be quite so competitive. At least it won't be far and away the better idea. So we're sort of hoping before we have to face that decision, and I'm not really involved in the company that much these days, we're kind of hoping that we'll have a regime where carbon is reflected in the price of coal. And once that happens, it won't be the least cost solution. It's probably the only way we can keep coal-fired plants from being built. And you notice the deal that was done down in Texas to cut 12 plants to 3 plants at Texas Utilities. Big deal, there's still 3 plants. So that's 3 more than I'd like to see us have, unless we can find a way to sequester the carbon dioxide from coal. And maybe that can happen, but as I mentioned in my remarks, it hasn't been done yet. So the challenge is in front of us, and a regulatory system of capping carbon dioxide is probably the only way to keep coal-fired plants from being the least cost solution. And that's the competitive world we're in. Yes, sir.
When you talk about the problem of new building codes, and we can congratulate some of the new buildings that are being built and some of the new systems that are used for conservation. But you also say at the same time that a lot of the problem is people's houses, yeah. Individual people's houses that yeah. haven't been insulated yes. that way. And how do we help those yeah. people change that? I mean, it seems to me an enormous investment, and you can't ask people who don't have the money to fully insulate their houses to come up to these kinds of new codes and expect them to do it, unless there's something that we can do beyond that with tax breaks and so on. But even then, it's extremely hard to do.
No, well taken. And the point being that almost every architect I know can build a zero carbon building today, and maybe even a zero waste building. But the problem is we have a lot of buildings out there that were built a long time ago, and what do we do about those? I've struggled most of my last 30 years and thinking about that problem, and all the things I've tried haven't worked very well. You know, I ended up, we started a company trying to deliver energy services. Our idea was that if you could sell people comfort instead of BTUs, there was a chance you could put a lot of investment in the demand side or in the system that produces that comfort instead of putting it in the energy. It didn't work. You know, our concept was a good one, but it didn't work. What do we do now? If I had my way and I could wave a magic wand, I would create a conservation investment bank that would allow low-cost financing for everybody in the country to buy all the insulation they could possibly put in their house, because it's hard to get a diminishing returns. And it would be the best investment the country could ever make, and there's good reason for the government to subsidize that investment. You know, that's probably not going to happen, but when you have something that's going to be a negative cost on climate change, you ought to be doing it anyway. I mean, it's something we ought to be doing even if we didn't care about climate change. It's a better way of utilizing our capital. So if I had my way, I would have a very easy access to capital for people who have existing facilities and some very easy standards to follow, that you would just completely retrofit their houses. Lex was just telling me that he bought 6 LED bulbs for his home in Georgetown. Well, they cost $30 a piece. Yeah, it's not an easy thing for a normal household to say, well, I'm going to invest in that, and we're not even sure the return is there. But certainly if you put carbon in the mix, we'd all be buying LED light bulbs, and we'd be bringing the cost down to maybe $15 or less. But even that is an investment. So if I could just wave a magic wand, that's what I would do. I am not so sure that that has promise as a policy in the U.S., but it's certainly one of the things that would work well. Yes?
Yes, I was wondering how you felt about a solution that's been proposed in Europe and it's been tried by several European countries, which is a flat-out carbon tax.
Yeah.
And just to level the playing field, we'll include a nuclear waste tax as well. This is something that I've been told is politically unacceptable in the U.S., but on the other hand, what's politically unacceptable today may be a necessity tomorrow.
Well, as a guy who got my boss fired for proposing a gasoline tax in 1974, you know, a lot of us have had our heads cut off by proposing just such an idea. Actually, I also think it's second best in my way of thinking, because it doesn't include things like capturing methane from feedlots, or doesn't capture avoiding deforestation or reforestation. There are a lot of solutions outside of energy that will help us in climate change. And so I don't want to lose that third of the solutions by just taxing fuel. I'd still, you know, if I can't do the first, I would do the second, because some way in the decisions people make, you've got to reflect the economics of carbon cost. And whether that's $50 a ton or whether it's $10 a ton, some way I prefer a system where the market would clear depending on the amount of creativity you and I bring to the problem. But that's just more of a market solution, and maybe I'm a little bit biased to markets for that reason. But boy, you know, at least a carbon tax, maybe not just a fuel tax or BTU tax, but have it related to carbon, is certainly the second best option and one that, we're most likely not to consider. Yeah.
I think a lot of what you talked about is a matter of political will, and I think you referenced that. It takes more than a change in individual behavior. It takes a change in politics and government to impose the type of cap that will create the economics for the trillion-dollar, $50 a ton carbon. In my experience and from my time on Capitol Hill and all the years I've been in Washington, so much politics is generated by capital formation and those who form and invest. Right now, they don't have the incentive because the cap doesn't exist. If you create the cap, they have the incentive and they'll drive it. So how do we change the political will and move it forward? And what's your prognostication on that happening?
Well, we have elections. You know, and It seems to me, if I heard anything in this last election, is that climate change is on the agenda. You know, it hasn't been for 6 years. It is now. And if I see both sides of Congress at this point, all of them are thinking about what kind of legislation should be introduced. So to me, it's not a matter of if, it's what. You know, I don't know what it'll look like. I think the worry of people is if they introduce a cap on carbon and let the price of carbon dioxide credits float to where the market clears, it may be so costly to our economy that they can't afford it. So a lot of the things I hear these days are, well, let's have a safety valve. So let's have a system of trading like that, but let's have a safety valve at $10 a ton or $12 a ton or something like that to get us started. And I for sure don't think that's the optimal solution, but it's sure better than not. And if that's what it takes, let's get it started. And we may be pleasantly surprised that the market clears below $10 a ton. But $10 a ton, you know, is what, probably 15% add on to wholesale electricity prices? That's not a, you know, so onerous or difficult that people wouldn't do it. So maybe there's something to that. Whether it gets anywhere, I don't know. But I all I can say is an election was held and people expressed their view, and it wasn't just about Iraq. There were other things on their minds, and I think climate change was one of those. And let's see what happens. It may not be veto-proof quite yet, but it's coming. Yes, one more.
No. You say that if you talk about a cap and a penalty for going over the cap or trading, being able to trade carbon, why can't you do the opposite with renewable resources and energy?
You could.
Why can't you reward people?
You can.
Exactly.
No, exactly. You know, everybody's worried in Kyoto that the developing countries aren't a party. But in fact, they are. Through the Clean Development Mechanism, if I'm in India and I find a way to put up a windmill that reduces the carbon dioxide of a bunch of megawatt hours, I can get paid for those credits by selling them into Europe. And so they're really participants. Everybody in the globe is a participant if, you know, if the U.S. once would join. If we joined, then I think the whole world would be part of a system where people would get paid for installing renewable systems, get paid for putting in windmills, get paid for biodiesel if that's what they want to do, get paid for conservation, which really is my point, is the least cost strategy. So I think that's the beauty of Kyoto as it's set up, is that it could, in fact, create a market opportunity for people to do just what you're suggesting. Whereas a carbon tax or something like that may be less of an incentive for somebody in India or China or Brazil to do something that would feed into the system. Should we stop there, President? All right. Thanks very much.
Just stand right there for a second. Suzanne, it gives me great pleasure to present you with the 2007 Benjamin Rush Award in recognition of your outstanding achievements in business, your exemplary leadership in a competitive global economy, and your persistence over decades in respecting the environment in the face of market realities. I might also say that there is a very nice convergence here this evening. We did speak of Dr. Rush, but he also had another interest. He was a scientist, and he was very concerned about the quality of air, and that began from an interest in the possibility of locating Dickinson College the current site of the Army War College. But he resisted the first president, he resisted the Board of Trustees, and he demanded that the campus be where it is today. The main reason was his concern with swamps, where the Army War College is, and that was coming up from the soil from the ground and causing an air, which as a physician he believed would be very harmful in this valley. A very interesting coincidence and very interesting for some of our contemporary concerns in the Carlisle area. So again, thank you so much. Congratulations for your achievement. And I honor you with this medallion with the profile of Dr. Rush. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
And again, on behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to thank Mr. Roger Tsant for speaking tonight, and I'd also like to present him with this plaque. If you have a free hand.
Okay. That's great. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming tonight. Have a nice evening.